Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we will discuss hepatitis. Our guest is Danjuma Ada, a leading advocate for hepatitis treatment in Africa. But first, the United States is helping 50 countries build up their healthcare systems as part of its new global strategy to prevent another pandemic, officials have announced Monday. U.S. government officials will work with the countries to develop better testing, surveillance, communication, and preparedness for such outbreaks in those countries. The U.S. program will rely on several government agencies, including the U.S. State Department and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, to help countries refine their infectious disease response. One example of current U.S. focus is the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is facing an mpox outbreak and is receiving assistance in several areas, the officials added. The White House on Tuesday is releasing a website with the names of the countries that are participating in the program. Biden officials are seeking to get 100 countries signed onto the program by the end of the year. We turn now to hepatitis, an inflammation of the liver caused by a variety of infectious viruses and non-infectious agents. It spreads by exposure to infected blood or other bodily fluids, and sufferers risk developing deadly cirrhosis and liver cancer. The World Health Organization estimates that 2 billion people in the world are exposed to hepatitis B infection. Of these, 350 million have chronic infection, with 65 million living in sub-Saharan Africa. The World Hepatitis Summit, which took place recently in Lisbon, Portugal, brought together experts, leaders, policymakers, and advocates with the goal to help eliminate hepatitis. For more insight, I spoke with Danjuma Ada, co-chair of the summit organizing committee and a leading advocate for hepatitis treatment in Africa, who was himself diagnosed with hepatitis in 2004. Take a listen.
So the World Hepatitis Summit is a joint event organized by the World Hepatitis Alliance, where I'm privileged to be the past president. The World Hepatitis Alliance is a global network of organizations around the world that promotes awareness about hepatitis. So the summit is usually organized in collaboration with the World Health Organization. The summit actually provided opportunities for national programs. When I say national programs, I'm referring to ministries of health and then hepatitis focal programs across especially LMICs in Africa and all over the world, and then patient and community groups to really interface, share experiences, share feedback on activities. But one of the major takeaways from this summit was the WHO, World Health Organization's Global Report. Access is called Global Access Report. And WHO published that report on April 9th. This global report came also after the newly updated hepatitis B prevention and treatment guidelines that were also released by WHO on 30th of March. So the summit was really very significant enough that for the first time, WHO released this access report that came from about 187 countries thereabout. It more or less after doing the prevalence studies, epidemiology studies across these countries. So the WHO now had the data published in order to guide national programs, in order to help in advocacy, and then to really elevate the visibility about viral hepatitis. The report of 2019 was 1.1 million deaths. Now the report by 2022 shows increase up to 1.3 million deaths. And it's so, so concerning. And then of this particular 1.3 million, 83% was caused by hepatitis B and 17% by hepatitis C. With this, it tells you that 3,500 people died daily, annually, due to hepatitis B and C infections. And over 6,000 people get infected on a daily basis. And it's really troubling that Africa, for example, my region, carries 63% of the global burden of hepatitis B. And then between 2019 to 2022, when this data was, when the WHO release did this survey, diagnosis for hepatitis B increased just by 3%, from 10% to 13%. This is building on the fact that countries signed up to the SDG goal of 2030 of eliminating hepatitis. And yet, nothing is being done, really. Yes, we agree with the fact that the data also shows decline in incidence, meaning new infections are declined slightly, especially because of prevention, hepatitis B, but mortality is on the increase.
Help us understand some very basics. What is hepatitis and how do you catch it?
Hepatitis is a Greek term called hepatitis, derived from the Greek word that is liver inflammation. There are different things that can cause the liver to be inflamed. So this one that we're talking about is viral hepatitis A, B, C, D, and E. These are infectious diseases that attack the liver and breaks down the liver and leads to what is called either cirrhosis or liver cancer. So hepatitis A, for example, actually doesn't cause mortality as the other ones. It doesn't cause chronic infection. So hepatitis presents in two conditions. It's just A is one of the causes only acute condition, meaning it causes sudden attack. It doesn't lead to chronic condition. Chronic condition is an effect beyond 6 months when the liver is now actually beginning to develop problems. So for hepatitis A, it resolves on its own and it goes without even treatment within 6 months. And that mostly occurs in places where there's poor hygiene, poor sanitation, and it mostly affects children. So it doesn't cause chronic condition at all. Now, the one that causes mortality, this one that I'm referring to, that kills 1.3 million, is the B and the C. Hepatitis B is the leading cause of liver cancer. And how do people contract it? Through the major body fluids. When I say major body fluids, you take away sweat, and this is one thing that fuels a lot of misconception and drives fear in the minds of most people. The major body fluid has to do with blood and body and blood products, right? So it could be transmitted through sexual means with unprotected sexual intercourse with an infected person. It could be transmitted through contaminated sharps or needles, and that is why it is promoted that we do harm reduction and minimize sharing exchange of needles. It also could also be transmitted from an infected mother to her baby, especially during delivery, and transfusion of unscreened infected blood. So almost the same like HIV. However, hepatitis B is 50 times to 100 times more infectious than HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Why? The hepatitis B virus, even when dried, could still be infectious up to 7 days. But HIV dies within 6 seconds, right? So if an infected hepatitis B blood drops on the surface and it's dried, it could still be infectious after 7 days. That's to tell you how infectious it is. Now, it causes two conditions. One is acute, one is chronic. For acute condition, is from the time of infection to up to 6 months. Usually, people get infected and most majority of people resolve it. Resolve it meaning the body develops immune response, and it goes on its own. But after 6 months, it's now the beginning of what is called chronic hepatitis B. So it is a slow progressing disease of the liver. When someone gets infected with hepatitis, it begins to break down the liver cells. The liver fights on its own because the liver creates new cells. Over time, it now begins to degenerate. It develops what is called fibrosis, cirrhosis, and liver cancer. So this slow progression, right, is what hepatitis B is. And that's why the unfortunate thing is that majority of people are infected, they don't even see the symptoms because the liver keeps fighting. So by the time the symptoms begin to show, most often it becomes too late because the liver would have gotten to the advanced stage of either cirrhosis or liver cancer.
What is the incidence of hepatitis on the African continent and also in terms of prevention and treatment, what is being done?
So global progress exists. There's still gaps across the region. So even based on the report the WHO released, Africa has 63% of hepatitis B incidence, prevalence. And one of the major modes of transmission is mother to child. However, WHO had recommended what is called HBV and bird dose vaccination. Less than 40% of countries in Africa, I think from the statistics, provide this bird dose vaccine to babies within the 24 hours of delivery. So the WHO African region bears 63% of the new hepatitis B infection. Yet, only 18%, you can imagine, only 18% of newborns in this region receive the bird dose vaccine.
Why is that?
Governments are not have not integrated bird dose vaccines into immunization systems, into maternal and child health systems in order to allow babies to be vaccinated. So the WHO recommends that babies are supposed to get the vaccine within 24 hours of birth. This
So
is really,
governments
really
need to take action. What
absolutely.
else need to be done? Is there something that communities themselves can do?
Yeah. So what the report also recommends, and some of us as patient advocates recommend, is increase awareness. There's very little about visibility of hepatitis. And this is one of the reasons. You have so many survivors of breast cancer, cervical cancer, but you have very few survivors of liver cancer. Very, very few. Because most often when diagnosis is done, they never survive, especially in Africa. And testing is in across most Africa, it is still out of pocket. Treatment is still out of pocket. I remember you're talking of a region where people live between $2, below $2. Now there is this negotiated price of generic medication for hepatitis B and hepatitis C. The off-patent generic hepatitis B treatment is negotiated at $2.40 for each patient per month. But only about 10% of countries that reported WHO are even assessing that. For hepatitis C, it's $60 for the 3 months treatment, but only very few countries have investment to procure that. So patients and people are left with their own fate, to out of pocket to buy medical commodities, to buy the treatment, I mean the drugs for the treatment and even for the cure. And it has driven many people into catastrophic poverty because of the out-of-pocket expenses for hepatitis B and C, especially across the African region.
My next question to ask you your experience. What was it like to be diagnosed with hepatitis B?
My background is in virology and public health, and this is the funny part. Despite this medical background, but I had very little knowledge about hepatitis. So getting the diagnosis, the first thing that came to mind was, oh, am I going to die from liver cancer? Am I not going to live up to my potentials? Because it was just like a death sentence. And the first time I had this stigma of, it was in 2004 when I just met the lady who I'm married with now. So it was difficult to disclose my status to her, but I was able to overcome the fear. And I told her, hey, the young man you want to marry, I have hepatitis B. And she was like, oh my God, what will she do? But so well, she was able to accept it and then did the test. We got married 2 years after. She was vaccinated, and we have five beautiful children that are hepatitis B negative. But 2 years after my diagnosis in 2007, I lost my mom to hepatitis C. And that was when I made up my mind that I needed to change the narrative. I needed to do something so that people don't pass through the pains I passed through. My mom passed on when my wife was pregnant with our first baby, so she never got to see that. And yet we had no agency, we had no power. The treatment wasn't affordable then, it wasn't even available then for most patients, and yet we were so misdiagnosed by healthcare professionals. So I had no agency. I felt I was so helpless. But creating my charity, learning, and investing in learning seminars gave me the agency, the knowledge, and the opportunity to help and save lives. So my charity now provides free testing to communities. We don't collect a dime. And then we link and refer patients, and we once in a while we've gotten donations from pharma companies. We give patients free without asking for any money. And this is what I've been doing over the past 10 to 15 years to ensure that we increase awareness. And that's why even this platform now is an opportunity to share my personal story, because it's traumatizing when you know that you have a virus that could cause you liver cancer, especially among men. The data shows that men develop liver cancer faster than women. So it's traumatizing. It affected my mental health at a certain point before I started taking the treatment. Each time I would stand before the mirror, I want to check my liver, I want to check, I'll palpate my high abdomen here, look out, join this. I started the treatment, I paid from my pocket for my salaries because it's not there in health insurance. So it's really concerning that many patients are there. Stigma has made so many people not to disclose status. And many people are denied even opportunities or even relationships or travels because of the hepatitis.
And before we wrap, what is your message to people, fellow citizens, just average people who may not necessarily know about hepatitis, or maybe those that are scared of getting tested. What is your message?
If you care for your liver, because hepatitis attacks the liver, so why should you care? Your liver is there. Your liver is the most important organ in the body, one of the largest organs. So get tested to know how your liver is. Get tested to know if, and I tell people across Africa in particular, you don't need to wait for government. So because health-seeking behavior is very important. We want to be survived. We want to be alive for your family, for friends. So you need to go and get tested. The fear of, I've seen a lot of people who say they don't want to be tested, so they're afraid to know if they had the disease. So, but on this, knowing it will help you to adopt healthy lifestyles, minimize risks. So even where there are no government programs, I encourage people to know their status, and know your status will help you have a good health-seeking behavior, and then to seek for care.
Danjuma Ada, co-chair of the World Hepatitis Summit Organizing Committee and a leading advocate for hepatitis treatment in Africa. He was speaking to us from Nigeria. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. Zambia has received the first shipment of a new medicine to prevent HIV infection. The delivery makes Zambia only the second country in the world after the United States to offer this injectable preventative outside of a research setting. Kathy Short reports from Lusaka, Zambia.
For 2 years, Precious Mbomboli took pills daily to prevent infection with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. But the 21-year-old is among the first in Zambia to receive a new injectable prevention drug.
For 2 years, yes.
I changed the new injectable on 25th February because the pill was difficult for me, as I used to forget to take it. Sometimes I was not at home at the time of taking the medication, so the injection makes me feel better and confident.
The new drug is known as Cabotegravir Grave, long-acting. Each shot prevents infection for 6 months. Zambia is the first low- or middle-income country to offer the drug to the public. Lina Mwango is technical director of the local non-profit CHEP Zambia.
Our target age group for this is adolescent girls and young women who are aged 16 to 24, as well as we're reaching out to their sexual partners.
Local representatives called connectors are helping roll out the program.
The connector is based in the community. We do community mobilization. We do community sensitizations. We go on screen the girls that are eligible for DREAMS. Those that are eligible get to be enrolled.
The U.S. government has donated nearly 15,000 vials of the drug known as Cabotegravir Grave. That's enough to protect 2,000 Zambians against HIV for 1 year, the U.S. embassy says. But experts say people who get the shot still need to take precautions.
People get the injection and then they think it's a silver bullet, in that then they can go out and sleep around. And really the message here is that that's not why this drug has been brought on board. To realize that this drug does not prevent pregnancies, it doesn't prevent other sexually transmitted infections.
About 1.4 million Zambians are living with HIV, with about 33,000 new infections per year. Experts hope the new drug can help bring those numbers down. Kathy Short, VOA News, Lusaka, Zambia.
Now get this, every few seconds, someone, somewhere needs blood. That's according to the World Health Organization. A blood transfusion can be a patient's lifeline, whether it is to treat medical emergencies, support surgeries, or aid patients with chronic illnesses. However, less than 1% of the population donates blood regularly. Observers say many countries in low-income settings struggle with collecting blood and storing blood. Reporter Mugube Davis Rwagakeringe has more from Kampala, Uganda.
Students at Kororo Secondary School in Kampala donate blood at temporary Red Cross Blood Collection Center. 18-year-old Juliana Mutony says, like most of her peers, she was worried that giving blood would make her unwell. But she found out that didn't happen.
What motivated me to donate blood today is to save the lives of patients who are out there who are suffering from different diseases so that they can regain their lives. And right now, I'm feeling well. I don't have any health difficulty because even right now, I can jump, I can walk, I can do anything I want.
Uganda Red Cross says students donate at least 70% of blood collected. Dora Mbanya, a professor of hematology at the University of Yaounde in Cameroon, says many people in African communities are skeptical about donating blood.
In some situations, people have to be affected directly for them to get up and go donate blood. They're so misinformed about so many myths about blood transfusion. Some say when I give my blood, you take it and you take my chance, my blessings with it. And so because of that, they wouldn't give blood. Others don't even understand why they should be altruistic. They think, oh, I give my blood and later on, people pay for it.
The World Health Organization says just half of the blood needed for transfusion each year on the African continent is collected, leaving many facing life-threatening shortages. In early March, dozens of experts from 40 African nations met in Kampala to discuss ways to dispel fears and boost blood donations. Dr. Diana Atwine, the Permanent Secretary at Uganda's Ministry of Health, outlines why Africa has to improve its blood transfusion services.
We are talking about high disease burden in Africa, malaria. We are seeing more cancers on the rise. We are seeing sickle cell, road traffic accident, mothers delivering and requiring blood. And so all those put a lot of pressure on the blood services in the country.
Delegates agreed to streamline safety procedures for collecting and storing blood. Sarah Mutegumbwa works for the Uganda Red Cross Society.
We are still having few people that donate blood, and we want to look for regular blood donation. You don't donate once and disappear, but you donate regularly.
She says health officials at the Kampala meeting agreed to work to demystify blood donations and blood transfusions. The delegates also agreed to reduce the need for blood transfusions by pushing to prevent diseases and road accidents in their countries. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Dr. Cynthia Chimonges is General Secretary, East African Division of the International Academy of Pathology. She discusses the challenges of blood donation and what can be done to increase the blood supply in health centers.
The United Nations Interagency Group for Child Mortality, or UNIDME, estimates that the global under 5 mortality rate has declined by 51% since 2000. Several low and lower middle income countries have outpaced this decline with a reduction of 75%, including Cambodia, Malawi, and Rwanda. In its new report, UNIGME says this progress is possible when resources are sufficiently allocated to primary health care, including child health and well-being. But the findings also show that despite this progress, 4.9 million children died before the age of 5, half of them newborns. The lives of 2.1 million children and youth between ages 5 and 24 were also cut short. Most of these deaths were in sub-Saharan Africa and southern Asia. At current rates, 59 countries will miss the Sustainable Development Goals under 5 mortality target, and about 35 million children will die before reaching their 5th birthday by 2030. This is primarily due to preventable or treatable causes such as preterm birth, complications around the time of birth, pneumonia, diarrhea, and malaria. The experts say many lives could be saved with better access to high-quality primary health care and low-cost interventions such as vaccinations and diagnosis and treatment of childhood illnesses.
That was a new report by the United Nations revealing that the number of children who died before their 5th birthday has reached a historic low. Now to Dr. Cynthia Chimonges, General Secretary, East African Division of the International Academy of Pathology on blood donation.
So blood donation
It consists of a voluntary act of giving blood to be used for transfusions or medical treatment. The moment a donor arrives at a facility for blood donation, and most of the time it will be a blood donation center, there is usually a questionnaire they're given to as an initial screening to determine if they're eligible for transfusion. This will include the age. Usually, look is between 18 and 65. We look at the major general health of the patient. It is usually held in private. Privacy and confidentiality is maintained. From there, the eligibility is determined initially at that phase. Then the next step, should they meet the criteria, then the blood is taken for further analysis. So the blood samples will be drawn, and also for testing, as well as the blood from the donor, which usually about 450 mils, is drawn about for 10 to 15 minutes. Even after the donation, they're given refreshments to replace the volume that has been donated. And that takes about almost 20 minutes to ensure the patient is stable by the time they leave. Now, the process of screening for infectious diseases like HIV, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, syphilis is done. And this is now where the second screening, or rather eligibility, is confirmed if this blood is actually going to be used for transfusion where it is needed. So we have the Kenya National Blood Transfusion Center that centrally coordinates these processes and policies that are now will be followed by these transfusion centers. You have 6 regional centers in Kenya and also 25 satellite centers. So through this mechanism, the need for blood is made aware, and also so that where blood is needed, it is transported accordingly. In my perception, why we need to give blood, because being a living tissue and with a limited shelf life, we need consistent a pool of blood donors. And also, as per WHO regulations, we need at least blood in our blood banks, about 1%, 1 to 3% of the total population. That means in our setup, we need about 550,000 units. Currently, the highest we've attained since the National Blood Transfusion was set up in 1998 after the bomb blast is the highest we've recorded in 2021 was about 40% of the requirement that we have. So we still have a long way to go. We still have a shortage in terms of what we need as per WHO requirements. And so we definitely need to have more of donors. We need to have more donors in our setup. The maximum that can be for males that can they can donate is around 4 times a year, and for females, because of the menstrual cycles, so the blood they can donate can be up to three times a year. And also given that females also to do with pregnancy and lactation, there might be the donation at that particular point might be deferred, even if they're willing to. So we'd have more donations coming from the males in a year compared to the females.
That is Dr. Cynthia Chimonges, General Secretary, East African Division of the International Academy of Pathology.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1. Then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. Thank you all for joining us, and thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linoch Mudu in Washington, with producer Mukbelia Barrow. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.